Here we are for episode 122. I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the first time I've certainly been back in the studio since episode one of Self-Hosted.
Welcome back.
What?
And you got Brent getting you set up all over there in the comfy chair, which is nice.
You know, yeah. Alex and I have special stories around those red chairs in the studio, so it's nice to have him back.
I don't think that's appropriate for the podcast,
Brent. Oh, sorry.
Jeez Louise. Yeah, we were just Linux festing, and it was a good fest. Saw lots of Self-Hosted listeners there.
Lots of hot dogs.
Yeah, we barbecued lots of hot dogs in the pouring down rain. I mean, really, really pouring down. Did a bit too much drinking, a bit too much eating. So it was a great time.
Yeah.
And obviously, we were on the road this week, you know, Brent and I, traveling for festivals and stuff. I know you're at home, Chris, but for some reason, I went to a hotel last night that was built right next to a train line, right next to a level crossing. So every hour or so.
Yeah.
Train horns blaring away. Beware of the trains.
Oh, yeah.
Alex,
you got to be train aware. We got a lot of goods to move here in the Pacific Northwest, Alex. A lot of goods, and we got to move them on train, Alex.
Why would you build a hotel next to that awful audible situation, though? It's just not a good idea, is it?
But Alex, you love trains.
I do, except when they wake me up every hour.
Yeah, that is it is legitimately sometimes even more frequent than every hour. When things are really booming. And I guess we have really strict safety policies, because if a train goes anywhere near an intersection, like, they got to really, really, really blast the horn. I've honestly thought about setting up decibel meters outside, because they snake throughout the entire county. And so almost everywhere in the county you hear a train. And I've thought about how, yeah, like, just a little decibel meter outside that, like, reports into a home assistant dashboard. Just track the loudness of the trains. Maybe I'd start to learn which trains make which sounds. I don't know.
That's kind of like that plane meter that you found, Alex. It tells you which planes are going overhead. Maybe you need one for the trains.
Yeah,
that could make it really interesting.
Is there such a thing? I mean, I would at least be interested from, like, if I got to hear it, I'd like to know, is that a coal train? Is that a passenger train? I can sometimes tell by the speed of it. Passenger trains don't really slow down, but the coal trains, they like to really come in slow and then really lay in on that horn for some long, thick, rich horns. You know what I'm talking about, Alex.
I do indeed. Now, you mentioned Home Assistant briefly just then. And one of the nice things about being here in person was I got a little tour of Lady Jupe's this weekend. And one of the first things my eye was drawn to was your little Fire dashboard tablet.
Which I just recently put swapped out that Fire tablet with, like, a $75 no brand Android tablet that's 10 inches, second tier CPU, but it's quad core. And 128 gigs of storage. I'm not sure, because it only needs to do one thing. And they, I think, are much better than the Fire tablets, because the Fire tablets have a lot of Amazon's crap on there. So you're either going to have to wipe them and reflash, or you're going to live with things like the fully kiosk app getting put to the background, even though you have every setting set to not allow that, and weird stuff like that. In the kitchen dashboard, I specifically try to show things that are relevant to my wife while she's cooking too, so she can manage certain electrical features, check temperatures and things like that. And then recently I've been supplementing in the kitchen with some kind of hidden buttons. So we have buttons in a couple different spots. One's not so hidden, but one is rather hidden. And so if she's doing something and she needs something to happen really quickly, we've identified those jobs. And I've just in the last few months, or maybe it's a little more than that now, really since Christmas, I've been kind of laying in physical buttons to control more and more things.
I noticed the four-way Zigbee control pad by the front door.
Yeah, I was happy to give you an opportunity to see that, because I really like that product. I'll have to see if I can dig it up and put it in the show notes. It's been super solid. It's a little quad panel, pairs immediately. And, of course, you can do multiple things with different taps and all of that. But something I wanted at the entrance, especially when we're boondocking and we're trying to conserve energy. Boondocking means we have no hookups, no power. And we were parked at the Linux Fest Northwest event in the driveway. No hookups, just running off of battery and very little solar. Thank you, rain. And so when we all leave, I have one of those quad panels there, and they all do the buttons. There's four buttons. They all do different things, but one of them is just turn off all the lights. Another button is turn all the lights, restore all the lights when I come back in. So whatever was on, or turn all the bedroom lights on, or turn all the living room lights on, depending on which one you press. And that way, when you're going out, it's just one button. One button out, one button in.
So with the news of Home Assistant this week, or the Home Assistant Foundation at least, no, Home Assistant Company creating a foundation called the Open Home Foundation, you must be feeling pretty peachy over there about relying on such a thing for your entire house.
I guess it seems like it's probably a good long-term thing, isn't it? They have a new nonprofit now, and they're putting all of their various projects, 240 of them, their standards, the drivers, libraries, things like their Wyoming protocol that we've talked about on here, the ESP Home project that's part of them.
That's a huge one.
Yeah. They're putting it all under this Open Home Foundation now. And yeah, it's all Home Assistant driven so far.
And Nabu Casa will stick around as a for-profit entity, I think, to support the salaries of the folks actually working on Home Assistant and some of the hardware side of things. But it is great to see that Paulus and, I presume, other folks in the Home Assistant management suite, for want of a better word, yeah, have their head screwed on right, that this is a project for the people. You know, the business model is us and open source and furthering the goals of, well, dare I say, humanity?
Well, that brings me to a question. We're seeing these foundations popping up a little bit all over the place, and I want to know why. You know, why can't they just keep the model they had? Was it not working? Was this part of the plan?
I wonder if it isn't several things, really. Probably in part it's a tax structure thing, but also I suspect it's about signaling confidence to the market that you're not dependent on a commercial company. You're dependent on a foundation that could exist outside the success of that company. Also, the fact that this was done in Switzerland plays a role. Paulus writes, quote, "I want to make it clear what our intentions are to the world, that we're driven by a higher goal than money, and that we are not for sale." He goes on to say, "Our articles state that, quote, there will be no direct distribution to members in return for activities performed for the association or any other gratuity in any kind."
Bravo.
Yeah.
I have nothing else to say other than this is fabulous news.
I mean, I think it's the idea, right, is to give confidence to users, to give confidence to commercial vendors that are making products, to give confidence to people to putting these things in your homes for a long time.
But does that put Nabucasa at risk? You know, they've changed their business model kind of here. So does that put them, the, you know, money-making entity at risk?
You know, I'm not sure their core business model has changed. They're still going to develop Home Assistant. They're still going to sell some of the hardware. They're still going to have the Nabucasa subscription for Home Assistant Cloud. I don't think much of that changes for them.
I think actually it's a positive, because if you are a vendor looking to integrate a standard or have that little, you know, made with iPhone or works with Home Assistant logo on the side, you want to be sure that if you're going to go through that pain of certifying and testing against such a platform, it's going to stick around for a long time. And so by having the core Home Assistant project not be subservient to Nabucasa as a company, instead it's serving the goals of the Open Foundation, we're seeing with Nix this week or the last week or two that power struggles, if you don't handle this stuff early, can be a real problem, particularly when money gets involved, which with hardware sales and subscriptions and stuff with Home Assistant is the case. So, you know, I think it's good that they're getting out ahead of that stuff.
And are we expecting other vendors to become part of the foundation or to interact with it?
Well, they did make some announcements. So that does seem like they've already been doing that, but that's going to be expanding. Supposedly, we have new partners announced like Aquera, Ultralog, and Jasco. And then also they're working with NVIDIA. That's why I say supposedly, because I don't know the details on that part. But they're working with NVIDIA also for local AI model incorporation. So I think along with the announcement of the Open Home Foundation, you're seeing this announcement of these vendors. To me, that seems like a bit of a signal. They also have the Home Assistant Works program, like Alex mentioned, where you can actually certify the products. That's probably where you'll be interfacing with Nabucasa. Maybe that transitions to the foundation.
We're reaching at a point with these open source projects where they are so integral to our lives that I just don't want to see them going away. And I'd actually almost like to see this Open Home Foundation be extended to other projects that are so influential in my life, such as a Jellyfin would be part of this kind of collective of projects, or an Image, or insert other project that you rely on here, because we've talked about it many times on JB for years about monetizing open source, and the motives of open source developers don't necessarily match up with being able to feed themselves or what you want from a project and things like that. And so we see forks happening all the time, and then these things kind of peter out over time. And I feel like by almost having this, I'm going to use the word collective, although it doesn't exist, I think it should. If we have this collective of projects to say, like, to be part of this collective, your project has to meet these kind of aspirational goals, or kind of your project has a certain philosophy, you meet our criteria, then I have the confidence as a person who builds solutions piece by piece at home that I can select that piece of a jigsaw, put it into my puzzle, and be like, okay, that problem is solved forever.
That does sound blissful.
Speaking of, I've been playing around with image a lot this week. Now, Brent, obviously you as a photographer extraordinaire, I'm sure you've got a lot of images to handle. And I'm curious what your workflow is right now for images.
You say images?
I know. I catch myself all the time saying images. And yeah, it's funny.
It's actually a pretty clever name.
Brilliant. My workflow has changed considerably in the last few years, going from a professional photographer to, I guess,
happy snapper?
A regular human with a phone. So it's been interesting to have to find different kind of solutions for that, because the typical workflow for me was go out into the world, do a job with a client, have a bunch of files on the camera, download those, and go through a process. And that was always part of the production process. So I had a system there that was pretty clearly defined. And these days, I don't got time for that. I just want my phone to, like, kind of deal with those things. So I've unfortunately come in and out of having automated solutions, you know, having backups happen automatically to Nextcloud or solutions like that. But since moving to a different phone in the last month or two, and just like my perpetual home network server infrastructure system being on the in flux, let's call it flux, I actually don't have a solution right now. So moments before the show, I realized that, because I'm hanging out with you guys thinking about infrastructure, and I made a backup of my phone, at least locally here on my laptop, but geez, it's in shambles.
What about you, Chris?
I've been using Image for a while, probably longer than I should have been, because I got a little grumpy there partway through.
Yeah, I remember that.
Changes.
The audience let us know that too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it, you know, it has been a bumpy-ish ride at times. I guess you could still probably count the, when I take photos with the iPhone, that's still backing up to Apple's thing. One of the things I really like about Image is putting it on both my iPhone and my Android phone means that I don't end up losing a picture. If I take it on one of the phones, they both are backing up to Image, and I really appreciate that too.
It's just there everywhere. Now, let me ask you both this. If you want to find a specific image, what's your typical kind of workflow for that?
Oh boy, Brent.
Brent's just laughing.
I mean, I can only imagine with this monstrous, like, caveman setup he's got going on here. It's got to be so bad.
Oh, Chris, you asked me to find a photo, a couple days ago, and you're like, you're never going to find
that. I think
that.
You did find it, though, didn't you?
Uh-huh, yeah. So I've gotten really great at, like, indexing where I think I sent photos to other people in my mind in different conversations on different, like, messaging platforms.
Is Telegram your backup? Is this what you're saying?
It's so sad when you put it that way. But
it probably compresses those images down.
Yeah, it's not. Big time. This is like... Yeah. I feel so ashamed as someone who cares about quality and cares about original photographs being preserved and such. So I am in desperate need of a better system.
There is a bit of a climb. I mean, you have to get an image server running, but their mobile app has gotten so good. I find when I'm searching, I tend to go to the web version of Image.
Yep.
There's just something like better, I think, about having the web browser, more view. And then I tend to either do it based on location or faces.
So what's interesting about the smart search, so what we're talking about here is sort of facial recognition and smart object search. Those are two things that historically have been kind of behind a big tech, I don't want to say paywall, because you never had to pay for Google Photos except for the storage, but you had to follow their path and upload your photos to their service and let them scrape your data. And we've always heard this argument of, well, I've got nothing to hide, so I've got nothing to fear with photos. And the reality is, people have asked the question, what are they going to do with all this data? And finally, in the last year or so, that strategy is becoming clear to the layperson that we're using these images to train AI models, at least for now. Who knows what it's going to be in a decade? Things like Midjourney and Stable Diffusion, we're all trained off of publicly available data sets, but we know, because it's public record, that Apple, Google, Microsoft, insert other company here, are using our data to train their models. And some of them are reselling that data set. And that is the business model now for these companies. So I've gotten on a bit of a high horse lately about trying to find a way around that. So with Image in particular, they have a machine learning container, which by default just runs on your CPU, and it's pretty slow, it's pretty resource intensive. But I was poking around making a video for work, and I found they have a remote machine learning section. So what I've been able to do is my gaming rig, which is running Windows, I installed Docker Desktop for Windows on this gaming rig. It's got an NVIDIA 3080 in it, so it's quite a powerful GPU. You run Docker Desktop for Windows, you paste in your compose snippet, and I'll put a link to the video that has all the instructions in the show notes. You paste in your compose snippet, and somehow the Docker Desktop for Windows thing gives you access to the NVIDIA GPU hardware acceleration underneath without doing any pass-through, without doing any weirdness. Like, it just kind of works, like, to the point where it's, is that it? Works, which is the best kind. And then you can, in your Image server, which can be on a completely different system, or it can be on a completely different side of the planet with a, you know, Tailscale connection, for example, you can put in a remote URL, which could be a Tailscale IP, or it could be a local LAN IP, of how to get to that container and the port number of where that host is. And you can run all your machine learning workloads against that remote GPU. So the ideal situation would be that you have a graphics card in your server full time. Every time you ingest an image, you run that through the GPU. But the reality is most of us are going to import our libraries once at the beginning. So for me, for example, a couple of weeks ago, I did this with Image. I set it up from scratch again. I've got about 120,000 images, about 2 terabytes worth of stuff that I've accumulated over the years. And it took a solid 3 or 4 days for this thumbnail generation to go through. But the machine learning component took a day. It was very, very fast. And I didn't really notice any issues across the local network at all in terms of performance for remote machine learning. They do mark it as an experimental feature in the documentation, for which there'll be a link in the show notes, of course. But my argument here is that you could put your gaming GPU to work every so often, because if your GPU is offline, all that happens on the image side is the job fails. And then you can be like, right, well, I know my desktop's offline this week. And then you can come back every few days, few weeks, whatever you want to do, and just press the button in the image UI to say rerun these jobs, and you're good to go. Mm.
You know, that idea of importing a giant library, probably, hopefully once, right? You know, you offered me something, Alex, that I think is a really great idea. You said, hey, I've got my GPU just sitting there because my image library is all done. Why don't you get your image going? And once you need to import everything, I could share my GPU to you from a distance and just have it crunch all the things.
Well, here's the other thing, right, as well. The quality of the facial recognition and the object detection is governed by the quality of the models, which we know is changing rapidly. And so you might want to rerun this machine learning task against your library every 6 months or so. And again, I don't want a graphics card in my server full time necessarily just to do that. So having this remote option, I find incredibly useful.
Now, how was the quality of the detections?
Fabulous. I can type in Porsche and it'll find pictures of a Porsche and a Lamborghini. And then I could put red truck, or I could put blue car on a beach at sunset. And it's better than Google Photos.
Wow.
I don't say that lightly either.
We did a side-by-side comparison because I didn't believe him. And I was like, show me, because I don't believe this. And sure enough, it was way better.
Hmm.
I think it was you, Chris. We were setting up for the live stream of Linux Unplugged at the festival.
Yeah.
And you said, I want a picture of your mixer at home, because we got the same mixer.
You're right.
And I've got some little channel strips with
labels,
some duct tape and some Sharpie to mark on some other channel names and stuff. And I thought, right, I wish I had a picture of my mixer. So I typed into Google Photos, mixer, and it showed me mixing bowls.
Right.
Or like pumpkin seed mixing bowls with Ella when she was little.
Yeah, like, kitchen mixers and whatnot.
That's not what I want right now. And I typed into Image mixer, and it just showed me mixing desks, like with faders and sliders. And it showed me your console in this room from 5 years ago my drums, and it was great.
I've been pretty happy with the face detection too, I have to say. Even compared to like Apple's face detection in Apple Photos, I think Image face detection has been pretty good. That's one of my primary ways of like, oh, I want to go find this picture of Dylan. I'll go look at this. Or I know that Abby, I think she came with us on this trip. Let me go look at a picture for Abby. Oh, yeah, there's Abby's face. You know, that kind of stuff. I just find it's gotten that better than Apple. I don't know if I really compared it much to Google Photos. But, I mean, that's really been my benchmark, is get it better than that, and I'm happy.
I have a note in the show doc that says, is it finally time that Image feels mature enough that I feel comfortable canceling my Google storage?
Well, I think my question comes back to some of the challenges that you boys had recently with updates and stuff. Is that getting better? Are there less breaking changes between updates?
I mean, I don't know. It doesn't really destroy the data. So what you could do ultimately, which I think Alex just said he did, and it's not that hard, is just blow it away and start over. You just have to redo the processing if there is an issue. So that's your hopefully unlikely scenario. I mean, I didn't have to do that even though I was several releases behind. But it sounds like it's not that bad of a scenario. It's just start over and let it re-index.
The updates are frequent.
Yeah. That's the thing.
That is the reality of it.
Yeah. They are good about communicating it both in the server UI and in the client UI. And there's even an info screen inside the client app that says, yes, server and client are up to date. You're good to go.
That is actually a good little gotcha on the remote machine learning thing. You've got to make sure that your server container versions match the one that's on your remote, you know, gaming rig, for example. I mean, you could do it set it up however you want, but make sure everything across the tool chain matches. Now, you know me, I love a good reverse proxy, unlike some people in this room.
Whoa.
Hey.
I'm looking at you, Brent.
Throwing shade.
I am. Yes.
I've moved past the reverse proxy, but that's all right.
I waited long enough that I don't need it.
That's not true. But anyway, Traffic V3 is out this week. It's been in RC for a little while, but the GA came out this week.
You're burying the lead as far as we're concerned. There's a very cool feature in there where you were telling us before the show that traffic can request via the Tailscale API an updated SSL cert on demand as needed.
Yeah, for Tailnet services. I didn't actually know this until I was prepping this episode, so that's kind of cool. Yes, but Traffic V3 has some breaking changes for your V2 stanza. So like if you've got labels and stuff like that against your containers,
yeah,
you'll need to add a basically like a legacy flag. There'll be a link to the announcement in the show notes. So just a heads up, really, you know, V3 is out. So if you happen to pull that down by mistake or otherwise and things stop working, you will need to add some new labels to your containers.
Now, you guys know that when we go on trips, we often talk about little things that we like to do, like set up something in the Airbnb with a little router and get some video streaming going. And then in the last year or two, one of our traditions has been to just fire up Pluto TV because it's easy mode and just put on the Star Trek channel and we just leave it on. See how far we get into a series. It's worked pretty good, but everywhere you go, there's different implementations of smart TVs and the Pluto TV app, and there's lots of ads. And this time we were here in the Pacific Northwest at the studio. We didn't have Pluto TV, and I thought, would it be cool, though, if I could replicate that? And I came across an app that we've been debating how you pronounce it, but I think it's like Ersatz TV, E-R-S-A-T-Z TV.
Yeah, I'll give you a solid 8.2 for that.
All right,
pronunciation.
Thank you. And what it does, besides just become a video streaming service, is it pretends to be a TV tuner so that apps like Plex will recognize it as such and actually pull it in as live television. Super easy to bring into Jellyfin, super easy to bring into Plex, or anything that supports an M3U playlist. And it even provides a TVDB schedule file so that way you can get a proper TV schedule and TV guide inside your app of choice. And the app is also capable of connecting to your Jellyfin or Plex library to pull in all your metadata and can do really fun things like play commercials in between shows, set up a broadcast schedule, and then have a persistent, always on, quote unquote, live TV that your Jellyfin or Plex player can tune into. And so I've created, just as an example, a Star Trek stream that'll play any Star Trek episode from my whole library, an Archer stream that's always playing Archer, and Superman, The Adventures of Superman. And when you pull up the live TV in Jellyfin or Plex, you just see three channels that are available to you. They're always on. They're always going. And you can do all kinds of neat things, too, like add in commercial breaks. So I have some 90s commercials in there. I'll put a link to the archive.org.
I feel a sudden urge to buy some Hot Wheels now. I can't explain it.
You guys saw the Hot Wheels commercial?
Oh, yeah.
And a Batman commercial too, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
This is really cool. It reminds me, like, when I'm traveling in particular, like, you go to your hotel room and sometimes you just want an hour of brain dead before you go to sleep, right? And you turn on the hotel TV and think, right, let's see what's going on this. And you end up watching some really bad 90s movie or something you'd never pick. But sometimes it's really enjoyable just to have that decision made for you.
You know, I even like that I usually, when I turn on the TV, it's partway into it.
Yes.
There's something about that. And it's the same with this. Yeah.
I don't know if I like it.
Yeah, because you have to fill in the blanks, right? I think it's more of a creative process.
I agree. And then also, if it shows you already know, you don't necessarily need to start at zero, you know? And why not just jump right in? Plus, you'll catch the next one. You'll catch the next one from the start. This one's just to warm you up.
I love how my first reaction when you mentioned this was like, yes, we get to do our own stream whenever we're in an Airbnb or something.
Yeah.
And I reacted and said, hey, no commercials, because that was really annoying this time
right.
around.
Right. So.
And yet.
Went ahead and added commercials.
Yeah, you did.
But only one commercial break.
But they are period correct commercials,
yeah,
if you set it up correctly.
Yeah, you could totally do that. So like for Star Trek, I did the 90s commercials. For Archer, you'd probably want to do something different. I was reading online that somebody just puts videos of their kids in between this. They have a big library. And you can have it. So you can have it pull from Plex. So it's acting as a Plex client or a Jellyfin client and actually streaming from the server too, along with pulling the metadata. Or you can have files locally on the disk, and you can just point it at that. And then, so that's my mix, is I have it pulling from a library, and I have the 90s commercials on a local folder, and I'm kind of just mixing the two.
So how's performance been? I know you were doing some stuff with, like, monitoring CPU usage before we started.
It will put your system to work if you don't grab one of the hardware-accelerated versions. They do have a couple of hardware-accelerated Docker images, depending on your GPU flavor. But otherwise, it's a lot of FFmpeg on your CPU. And, Alex, there's a gotcha, too. And it's not so bad with Jellyfin. In fact, Jellyfin, it's super easy to set up. It just, what's the M3U URL? Okay, no problem. Okay, yeah, you can add a schedule, sure. With Plex, first of all, you got to have Plex Pass.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
To even get the DVR live TV feature, you got to have Plex Pass.
So what's the signal chain here? It reads from disk, and then what?
So then you send it to Plex, and Plex will pull it in as a TV HD tuner, like a HD home run. And the EVSAT TV, whatever it is, will stream the video to Plex. Plex will pull it in using the HD home run emulation stuff, show it to you as a 1080p, 30 frames per second, AC3 audio video.
That's an important limitation, right?
They're all that right now, yeah. They're every video, no matter what size resolution you play. 1080p, 30 frames a second.
So it upscales the source, right?
Yeah, or downscales.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then Plex, once it's pulling that in, then, to be super helpful, DVRs it for you. So then Plex is decoding it and also writing it to disk
so
again.
I hear you like to record your recordings there, dog.
Yeah.
Isn't this just a really strange way of doing it because they're trying to fit into this box,
yeah,
which is TV, yeah, channels and such? I find these projects so, like, wonderful in a way, a weird kind of strange way.
Yeah, it's tricking Plex into thinking it's an actual TV tuner. And so Plex is treating it like an actual TV stream that you'd want saved to your hard drive. Jellyfin's a lot smarter about it.
I mean, you could replicate a lot of this with like smart playlists and stuff, but you wouldn't get the kind of,
yeah,
appearing mid-episode thing, and you wouldn't get the commercials thing, and you wouldn't get the pausing like TiVo style thing. Like, some of this is not born out of being sensible. Some of this is born out of nostalgia, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, we've worked so hard to get on-demand TV, especially local on-demand stuff, and look at us now. We're just hitting the reverse button, or rewind, if you will.
Well, hey, the streaming services have tried to recreate cable, so why don't we?
You know what, too? Is for me, it's like I'm always focused on what's new in my library. And I have all of these great shows, some of which I've loved for a lifetime now, that I want to keep them, but I don't actively watch them. And the choice of like what episode in a, you know, seven season show which one of these episodes am I going to watch? I just skip it. I move on to the new stuff, or I'll just go watch a YouTube or something like that. But now I'll have three or four channels that are always playing of a show I like. And if I just want to pop in and have something going while I'm cooking or cleaning or whatever, I think it's going to be a go-to choice. It's like a way to resurface these old video files that are just sitting there on my hard drive, eating up space that I'm not actively watching anymore.
It's like reruns.
Yeah, it's reruns of my library.
Can you do like a just random all?
You could just make one huge playlist, yeah.
I'm starting to
like this.
I find myself wasting way too much time on YouTube autoplay. I'd much rather it was going through content that I'd already selected that is, useful, you right. know, to me, or actually has some proper production value to it, because maybe this is just anecdata based of Alex's experience in the world, but I just don't feel like YouTube is that interesting at the moment. I don't know if they've changed the algorithms a lot. And
yes, I agree.
I go to the front page these days and it's just like, eh.
Takes me forever to find something I want to watch now.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah. And it's also like you watch one wrong thing and it changes all of your suggestions.
They're so aggressive with that. I don't know if it's a TikTok thing that like the recommendation engine on there is really good at figuring out what you like. And then YouTube's gone, oh, we need to do that and whatever. Yeah. But one, if Ella watches one video about, you know, kinetic sand or something, that's all I'll see for a week.
Chris, for someone like you who likes to have something playing when you're trying to get work done, do you think this will speed up your like time to productivity?
I like this. I like that idea, and that's where I was thinking too. And the other thing that I should mention is it's an M3U stream, which means you could just take the URL, which it just makes really easy for you to find, and it's sort of like header bar of the website, because that's a pretty good little dashboard. You could just right-click on that, copy URL, and paste it into VLC, and you could just watch one of those television streams in VLC, anything that can, you know, decode H.264 over a URL. And so I wouldn't even have to launch Plex or Jellyfin to watch it at my desk. I could just do it in any of those apps. That's really appealing. And it still follows all the scheduling and the commercial breaks and all. It's all the same exact experience. It's just a really lightweight player on my desktop and not even in a web browser. And it's like, and I could just have those bookmarked in VLC. Just click it. Boom. It's playing.
It's deliciously retro, deliciously futuristic. Back to the Future, anyone?
You can do movies, too. You could do a movie channel.
You see, I'm getting all these ideas, too. Like, could you hook this into, I don't know, something like Home Assistant and have it so that Frasier's playing whenever you come home?
Oh, man, they need Home Assistant integration. That would be a good call. I've been wondering, I have not gone this far, but because it is acting as a Jellyfin or a Plex client when it's streaming from your library, your Jellyfin or Plex integration into Home Assistant may then pick it up. In fact, I think this would be the case, would pick it up as a playback activity. So you may be able to play or pause it, or at least be able to determine when it's running or not. So I, you know, when you say that, the wheels are spinning. I think there could be some possibilities there.
Well, Chris, when you were playing with making your own TV network here in the studio, I was playing with a little application that got sent to me by listener Daniel, our Team Linux. And we've seen this one come around, but I don't think any of us have tried it. It's called Local Send. Have you guys tried this before?
I did see there was a Techno Tim video on this fairly recently, so I'm familiar with it, but I've never actually used it.
So the idea here is it's like a your own self-hosted AirDrop. I went into this a little skeptical. It's like, oh, one more like local transfer client. But it's kind of slick. This thing is available in tons of places, like pretty much everywhere. There's a mobile mode, desktop, web. You can do headless. It can be a server. You can find it so on Windows in many places, like Chocolaty. You could do Homebrew. It's got a flat pack. It's in the AUR, Next Packages, App Images, F-Droid, even Fire OS. So this thing is like everywhere, which is a really nice thing for file sending.
Fire OS is actually really good to see. I know this sounds silly, but if you think about it, when you get some of these crappy Android tablets and you just want to put like one APK on there, how do you get one stupid APK on an Android tablet that you don't want to sign into, that you don't want to put any identifying information into? How do you do it, boys? This could be really great. And the fact that it's an F-Droid, too, means you could just sideload it.
So walk me through the process, Brent. I've got, for example, at the fest this weekend was a perfect example. I took a selfie with someone who was wearing some merch of a YouTuber that I know, and I wanted to send it. The guy asked me, can you send me that picture? And I was like, well, you've got an iPhone. I've got an iPhone. We physically touched them together and it just airdropped between the two. What would that look like to a complete stranger in that situation?
Yeah, so I mean, AirDrop sort of sets the standard and has for a long time. This offers a few different options. So if you're transferring things just for yourself, you can set it up, you know, install clients on either end. But what I was impressed by is it also offers the ability to just create a URL or a QR code.
Oh, cool.
So it's just basically your device is hosting an HTTP server just momentarily to allow you to transfer this file. So it kind of spins it up whenever it's needed. So you can access this, you know, over Tailscale. You can access it over a few different ways.
And I presume it probably on a mobile device. When you want to send a file, it just shows up in like the share sheet initially. Is that how you like get
it? Yeah, you can
send this file to you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's got all sorts of, that's what one thing I appreciate about it is many different ways of accomplishing the same end result. It's pretty clever that way.
This is, I mean, and the fact that it is cross-platform kind of makes it a winner for me because I am trying to move, and also desktop. Now, do they have to be on the same Wi-Fi network for this to work?
Do you know? So I think in the most simple form, mm-hmm. it does. Now, I was trying it through TailScale and such too, but I think there's a way that you can host a server.
Oh.
That's just kind of running 24/7.
Uh-huh.
That's the key, right? Is how does the discovery happen?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it seems like there's multicast UDP is kind of the default mode happening here. And then they have a lot of escape hatches. So in case that's not working for whatever reason, there's a nice little advanced button. And you can put in your own IP addresses or host names to kind of help this resolve itself. It also has the ability to create bookmarks and to name your own clients as well. So if you're, you know, like in your case, Chris, you're sending files around pretty regularly. Every week it's predictable. Then you can set this up in a way that's really quite permanent in a way, but also it can just behave really quickly. You know, it just gives you, it just kind of automates everything on the two devices and transfers pretty quickly.
I see it's available in Chocolaty on Windows and a portable zip. It's in the Mac App Store, Homebrewed, and they have a DMG on Linux. They've got AppImage, Nix Package, AUR, FlatHub, DebTar. It's in the Play Store, F-Droid, get the APK. It's in the App Store for iOS. I mean, you're right. It's really everywhere, Brent.
But I think for an app like this, it has to be, because the whole idea is that it's available in every device everywhere.
Now, I see in the show doc here, you got something about Android downsides.
Uh-oh. By the way, again, if we didn't say this is Local Send, I think we mentioned the name, but it's Local Send.
Yeah, I've got some a section in our doc here, thumbs up and thumbs down. As always, it's good to explore those. Thumbs up, I use it on TailScale with no issues, which I don't think is surprising. It doesn't even need to know about TailScale, right? And it also has a slick UI. It's written in Flutter, which is cool. It also optionally encrypts the information with self-signed SSLs.
Okay.
Which is kind of a neat. It's off by default, but you can enable that.
That's good to see.
As far as downsides go, I found in my limited testing before the show here that transfers on Android, it seemed to need to have the app open. So if I switched and multitasked to different apps, it would still keep running for, you know, maybe 30 seconds and then maybe some battery.
Come on, Android. That's your thing, is running stuff in the background all day.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, that's my fault. I'm going to go in and modify, you know, the battery optimizations. That makes total sense. You have to do that at every single open source app, it seems. So I went and did that, and no change. Maybe I'm missing something there, but that was a little bit annoying because I want to just run this in the background, right?
Yeah. You'd love it to almost be like a service level thing.
Yeah, and I wonder if there are ways around that. I also found about 50% success with discoverability here on the local network. So, but I was able to define things myself, and then everything was just peachy. So there's that. And I think another downside is actually that you can encrypt things with a self-signed SSL, and some things just complain about that.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah. Standard. Like if you're opening this in your browser, right, it's going to give you a warning or whatever, which is just a annoying use case.
Yeah. Although, so it sounds like out of all of these, like if you were just, I'm person A, this is random person B, the QR code scanning might be the most bulletproof, right? Because then it's going to know the URL. It's going to know all the details. It doesn't have to auto-discover.
Yeah, you know, I didn't try this scenario with random person. I guess I could have pretended not to know either of you and not been on the same local Wi-Fi network, right? Because if you have a network that's isolating clients, I don't think this is going to work very easily, right? You need some way that these devices can find each other. And that might be the limiting factor in the sharing, you know, photo with stranger use case. I didn't see anything about like sharing with Bluetooth or anything
that'd be neat, for instance.
But maybe that's in the future works for this.
I wonder if the listeners out there have any great apps they use to transfer data between multiple devices. They boost in with those, especially if it could do cross-network, multi-transfer at once to multiple devices, things like that. I'd love to know what people are using.
We've talked about Magic Wormhole before. That's one for me on the server side that's pretty good. And one nice thing about Wormhole is that it sort of does NAT punching for you a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's surprisingly great. Wormhole send, wormhole receive, and pop, pop on the server. It's cool. And I'll just
Pop, pop.
You know, do it in a session, detach from the session, let the transfer go in the background, then I'll forget for 3 months that I had it running. It's great.
I'm sorry. I'm still a little scarred from the weekend, spending it with your kids, taking the mickey out of my accent all weekend. We're saying pop, pop over there. I had to say water 3,000 times for them, and zebra this weekend.
They've got to implant it really deep into their memory so that way they can try to recall it on demand.
They were a hoot. I mean, it's crazy to me. The last time I saw Dylan was Denver for the reunion, which is 2021, I think. He's enormous now.
I know. Well, Brent keeps feeding all three of them.
and they keep beating on me, so they're getting those muscles.
That's true. It's making them stronger.
Well, we saw lots of you at Linux Fest Northwest, several self-hosted t-shirts, one Chris and the Badger t-shirt.
That's no right.
Less.
That's right.
That was great.
We should have had made a Linux Fest Northwest shirt.
Yeah.
Maybe we will next time. Let's try to remember.
Let's do that.
It'd be really fun. It was great to see some of you, and we heard from some of you in the boost too. Paleo Nerd came in as our baller booster this week with 101,010 sats.
Can I just say that is quite the baller boost.
Nice, yeah. It's like a binary boost. 101.10. I like it. From the podcast index says, first time booster. I love all the JB shows, and self-hosted is my favorite.
Well, of course.
Thank you, Paleo Nerd. I really appreciate
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Eric, our podcast comes in with 32,768 sats. That's an important number too. So try to figure if you can noodle that one around 32768. Eric writes, another terrific episode. Casey's interview brought back fond memories of building a custom Linux HDT PC to run my Myth TV box. I recorded cable shows with the HD Home Run Prime back in 2010.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like we were channeling a little bit of that energy today, Eric. He says, that box was a crash course in backing up databases and building a custom NAS to store all of those shows. Yeah. This boost is not a zip code, but it is a key spec from a beloved retro gaming system. Dare to guess.
Ooh, I know. This was probably how much a Raspberry Pi cost during COVID.
I was looking at it. I did see that the PS3 had a special association with the number 32768, but I didn't get any closer. Did you have a guess?
All I can think is A, B, left, right.
Yeah, I know, right? Nothing. I thought maybe it was like a processor. I went pretty nerdy on that one.
Eric, you're going to have to let us know the answer.
Ms. Enutech 666 comes in with 20,000 sats, and she writes, boosting for my husband again. Thanks for all the hard work, guys. I know how much the show means to him. Keep up the good work.
Well, that's really sweet.
Yeah. We're sitting here podcasting. Your husband's out there doing the good work, and we appreciate him and you. Thank you very much for that boost. Evil Emperor Zerg comes in with 2,222 sats, a row of ducks. It says, does anyone have a good Teams-like app for home use? With a baby, my wife and I would like to start sharing notes, have a wiki, and just a general easy sharing of info and docs. Would Nextcloud be the right choice?
Well, this question, I don't know, is Nextcloud any good, Brent?
I mean, I'm a little biased,
no.
So I'm currently working at Nextcloud. I happen to be wearing a Nextcloud shirt this morning, which I don't usually wear, but it was the last thing in my travel kit that wasn't dirty.
How do I get a Nextcloud shirt?
Oh, jeez. Oh, yep.
Okay.
You gave an excellent talk at Linux Fest about what's coming up in, or what's been released in Nextcloud fairly recently. There is a bunch of stuff beyond just it being a Dropbox style replacement.
Yeah.
That's like the five year ago version, right? It does a bunch of other stuff now.
Yeah, I think
including talk and chat and video apps and notes, like all the stuff you just said.
Yeah. So the question here, would Nextcloud be the right choice? I think it's actually a perfect choice because you can get it up and running and use just the basics that you need now, but it can grow with you as you grow in your needs. So if you determine that you want, I don't know, something fancier down the road, like a mapping application your family can use, well, you can...
Recipes, you know, application, Brent. I got to say that.
Love that.
The house app approval factor on Nextcloud went up a lot when we got the recipes app in there. And, you know, with a baby too, especially if the baby has any special dietary requirements or, like, you know, I had one of my kids, my firstborn, had GERD, so we had a lot of dietary restrictions very initially on. You know, having special recipes was great. Just and notes and all that kind of stuff. So useful.
And coming back to our sort of building blocks conversation, Nextcloud is one of those projects that I trust to be around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sustainable business behind it, so you know that it's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would say start there. You say Teams like app is what you're looking for. It's exactly what Nextcloud is trying to offer an open source alternative to. So great start. And let us know if you need some help with that.
I want to say Mass Kottner is our next booster. Mass Kottner, 2000 sats, his first time booster from the UK, started with self-hosted in 2020 from the Home Assistant content. Thanks to you guys, I now have a basic $200 PC running Jellyfin and Home Assistant with remote access via Tailscale to my media.
Yeah! Oh yeah.
Although all of it is running on Unraid. Wow, that's great. As a complete novice, Perfect Media Server and the likes were just a step too far for me at first, and started to get disheartened when I couldn't get it working. Unraid solved that for me and fueled my interest. Now I listen to all the JB shows while I work.
Well, Unraid is a recent addition to our sponsor catalog on this show, and there's a reason for that. You know, we try and find sponsors that align with the audience's feedback that we hear of projects, and it really is a standout, you know, getting started project for
folks. We hear that all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
Now, one other thing I'll say is hello to a fellow UK buddy. I'm actually taking a trip to the UK this summer, 3 weeks or so.
Cool.
I don't know when yet, but I would love to meet up somewhere. Maybe London, maybe Cambridge. I'm not sure yet. Somewhere around that area, maybe Norwich. Somewhere fairly central anyway. So keep an eye on meetup.com/JupiterBroadcasting for the details there.
Oh, I'm already jealous. Are you a little jealous already?
Oh, my match up with when I'm in...
Oh, I hate you so hard right now,
Brent.
Oh,
Brent, can you come too? We should, if you can, we should make that happen.
I'm in Berlin for about 2 weeks doing a Jupiter Broadcasting meetup there, which you can find at meetup.com/JupiterBroadcasting. And it might just coincide with your trip too, Alex.
Oh, I hate you both so hard right now, but that'd be so great. That'd be so great.
Do they let mooses on the tube? I don't know.
They hide them in the cargo.
Oh, good, good.
Oh, yeah.
I also wanted to give a shout out to LegoFeed. He sent in 14,000 sats, but I couldn't quite understand his question. It was about Nix and Proxmox. If you want to restate LegoFeed and send it in, though, totes haps to try to answer that. Also, 5,555 sats from Jordan Bravo, 5,000 sats from NX201, and one more one on there because that's 211. Thank you, everybody. We actually had 11 boosters. We do a cutoff for time there, but we appreciate all of you, and we will put the boost that we didn't get to linked in the boost barn. We stacked 186,229 sats. If you'd like to boost the show, go grab Fountain FM. It's been getting so many great improvements. Or Podverse, which is a GPL app that also runs up in the web. Or Castomatic, if you're on iOS. It's like the luxury podcast experience over there. And we really appreciate the boost. It's a great way to send a little appreciation for this episode and get your message on here, too, and ask us some questions.
This is something I don't normally get treated to during a recording, but a wild Levi has just wandered into the room.
We got a podcast dog.
This is so great.
Well, too bad we don't have a way to keep track of the episodes that we've had Levi here, too. He could be like listed as co-host.
You know? Oh, yeah. That would be amazing.
He's such a great podcast dog.
He's a good boy. What about you, Brentley? Is there anywhere you want to send people? Anything you got going on?
I think Linux Unplugged is a place to go check me out, along with Chris and that Wes guy. We did a really fun episode this time around at live from Linux Fest Northwest. I think it's the very first time we did that, and Alex, you joined us.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, we've been talking about Linux Fest. Go catch that episode. Go catch some of the shenanigans right there over at linuxunplugged.com. Good idea.
You can find me on the internet at alex.ktz.me.
All right, I'll be at chrislast.com again. I'm doing that. I'm doing the Nosfer thing one more time.
I don't know where you can find me. I think I'm on Twitter. But you probably have a hard time spelling. But so just find me at Linux Unplugged and everything's linked there.
We need to get you a link tree set up, Brent, don't we? Something like that.
I bet your profile on this episode will link to your socials.
You're right. Yeah. If we did that properly.
I think we did.
Check me out.
There you go.
Thanks for listening, everybody. That was a special in-studio episode of Self-Hosted at selfhosted.show/122. Well, we did your breaks yesterday. How are they?
They're feeling pretty good, although I haven't given them the full onion yet.
Yeah.
I've been still babying them, doing about, 20% at max breaking.
Okay.
Just trying to treat them good.
So when we were in Austin a couple of weeks ago, Chris said to me, Alex, I really need to do the brakes on my Golf.
Yeah. Mostly I was looking at the lip on the rotor. I was like,
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
That thing's almost like a cereal bowl.
Yeah.
The brake pads were in better shape. The brake pads were, but the rotors were ready to go.
We didn't do too bad, actually. I was expecting, I didn't know what the tool situation was here, We only had to go to the auto parts store three times.
Well, we still haven't gone back to drop off the torque wrench yet.
We went four times, and we have yet to go again to return the tools that we have and the parts we didn't need.
I only snapped one ratchet wrench, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty good. So then we had the experience of trying to replace just one wrench.
How'd that go?
I mean, pretty good, actually, I have to say. A little time intensive, but not that bad.
Yeah, so for those that aren't familiar, Craftsman in the US is a very long-standing brand of lifetime warranty, which means it's been it used to be at, where was it, Sears, I think, for generations. Yeah. And then now it's been stocked by Lowe's and a couple of other places. I think I've seen it in Ace Hardware too. But the whole shtick with Craftsman is that if you break something, you just go into the store and they'll swap it out for a new one.
Yeah, and Alex was tightening some lug nuts on the wheels. And
I definitely wasn't putting a pipe on the end of a little 6-inch wrench.
And no, then definitely sparks not that. Came out of the thing. I'd never seen that before. No, sparks shot out of this wrench. It was wild.
That's how strong he is.
And then it wasn't working.
Yeah.
Yeah, it went snap with a pretty good amount of velocity.
It was more of a clink.
So what did you think of the process? How was changing the brakes? Was it your first time doing a brake job?
Yes, on that car, but not brakes in general. But I was glad to have you there just because, I mean, what, have you done 100 of them on the GTI? So.
Oh, every time I go to the racetrack, I have to swap in my racing sort of track pads with a more aggressive compound. And then when I get home, I have to swap them back to the street pads.
Right.
So, lots.
You do the pads, but do you do the drums, the
rotors?
Yeah.
The rotor. So that's an interesting question, actually. Typically, no. And the reason is because the manufacturer of the pads I use is the same on track as I use on the street. So the compounds are based in similar makeup. They have like similar chemicals in them.
Ah.
Whereas if you switch brands and don't switch your rotors, you can actually end up with judder as the pads don't mate with the rotor surface properly. So you were talking about bedding them in with a sort of 20% braking.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing. You're trying to put a nice, even film of coating on the rotor so that when it, mates with the surface of the pad every time, it's not an uneven surface.
Right. Right. So when do you think I can start really giving it the onion then?
Well, probably now.
Oh, good.
If you've driven home and back, the braking procedure officially is you do 3 or 4 stops from 50 to 30 at sort of 20% pressure.
Yeah.
And then you build it up and do a few of those at sort of 50% pressure. And then you'll do a 70 to 20 and a 50 to 10. And you'll do those big stops as hard as you possibly can once it's up to temperature. You don't want to heat shock the disc, the rotor to start with. The idea is to build up the heat gently with those light pressures, then do the really hard stops.
Okay. So now it's hard stop time. Once up to temperature.
Once you've warmed them up a little bit. Yeah.
So we got to warm them up. Going to be a fun drive home.
We put some more aggressive pads on the front there too.
Yeah, that's why I'm looking forward to trying them out. You know, I mean, I never really had any complaints. It's a small car and they put good brakes on there to begin with. But it was a clear upgrade swapping the pads out. Just the way they look, the surface area difference, plus new rotors, you know. So it feels like a treat, you know. And it's something I actually could do again, I think. Nothing about it seemed really, I mean, it was nice to have a second hand or even third set of hands, but I could even see one person getting it done pretty straightforwardly.
It's rare the three of us are all in one place.
Yeah.
All at one time. I mean, Jeff, listener Jeff, bless him, was up at your RV fixing the water pump on the RV and missed it, unfortunately. But I was left with an impression that wouldn't it be great if we had like a JB compound and all of us lived close enough that, Brent, my exhaust fell off.
No, I'd be saying my exhaust fell off.
Our cars would be in perfect shape if we lived near each other.
Yeah, that's for sure. We get so many things done.
I feel like my infrastructure would be in better shape, too.
That's true.
So I had this shower thought earlier, gentlemen.
Gross. I didn't need to know that.
No, it's kind of my think tank, and I don't know if anyone else.
Everybody is. Of course, really? I didn't need to know you were taking a shower.
Well, sometimes it's the hot tub.
Okay.
Anyways. This is weird. Concept, I thought. I want to know what you guys think of this idea, or if you've seen anything like it around.
Okay.
So I have a deep, it's kind of tied to our topic, actually. I was thinking about image and like organizing my photographs and feeling bad about myself and this current situation that I have. And, you know, it's really nice to find your photographs on a map. And yet I have GPS turned off on all of my mobile photos because of privacy reasons.
Oh.
You know, I'm sharing photos with a bunch of people and I just kind of don't want that out there all the time.
Yeah.
Well, so my default has just been to have it off at all times.
Oh, you're missing out. It's
That's
fun.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. What you need, and there's plenty of them, is you just need to find one you like. It's a little app that when you want to share, you send it through that app first. It strips all of the metadata out, and then it forwards it on.
Yeah, I know about these, but it's like just another step, yeah. And what if you forget, or like, is it inconvenient, et cetera, et cetera. So I do know about that, but I think I came up with a concept that might solve this.
Okay.
It's in the rough works, and I haven't even jotted it down, but I want to see what you guys think. So we've talked about the concept of like key sharing to have some privacy, like Nostr is a good example of that, right? You can have an identity around. What about the idea of having your GPS info in a photograph tied to a key? So it's encrypted, and if you have that key, you can read it, no problem, and you send it to strangers, it's just a bunch of gibberish.
Yeah, like if of course, the only problem is it would require every device in the world to write some sort of encrypted metadata instead of plain text, but I would love the idea.
I know.
And where would the private key live?
Yeah. That's the worst part. You lose your private key, you lose everything.
Oh, but like, yeah. Well, you just lose the GPS coordinates. But still.
Anyways, if anyone has a better solution than anything we described here, please help me.